Movie Squad is sponsored by Luna Palace Cinemas, WA's premier independent cinemas, bringing the best film content and cinematic events to Perth. Come and enjoy the Luna Palace experience.
Toast.
Toast.
Right here. Right now. The most important thing in life will always be the
Movie Squad.
Salute me, familia.
Welcome to the Movie Squad podcast. My name is Tristan Fidler.
And my name is Simon Murata.
This is the podcast version of your weekly edition of Movie Chat, broadcasting on RTRFM 92.1 Friday morning, 7:30 a.m. with breakfast host Pam Boland. And on the Movie Squad podcast, we discuss new cinema releases, both blockbuster franchise entries and indie movies that, divide audiences, or divide this audience in that we had different takes on the second film that we talk about, Simon.
That's right, The Sweet East, a film that set tongues wagging in the Movie Squad chamber. But no, a really fun conversation in the second half of this episode about the new film starring Talia Ryder, Ayo Edebiri, and Jacob Elordi from mumblecore cinematographer Sean Price-Williams. But first, we go big, don't we? Tristan.
Yes. We go back to the Planet of the Apes with Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, a new film in the ongoing series that spans decades. And this time it's directed by Wes Ball of the Maze Runner movies and starring Owen Teague and Kevin Durand and William H. Macy. But we're going to talk about the new Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, get a little bit about the history, understand what's going on with this version, and you're going to hear a little bit from the trailer right now.
Are you familiar with the concept of evolution? In their time, humans were capable of many great things.
Noah!
They could fly like eagles fly. They could speak across oceans. But now it is our time. And it is my kingdom.
Every Friday here on Breakfast, we take some time for the cinematic arts. We look into the brains of the blockbuster babes. Simon Murata, Tristan Fidler, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. You even laughed in time. That was so good. Simon, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Good to be back.
Good to be back. You had a little week without? Yeah, we had Lucy in last week and it was gorgeous. We love Lucy, but we also love the team to be reunited, so it's great.
It was great for me to listen to Tristan and Lucy talk about two films that I hadn't seen, and I'm really excited to see Housekeeping for Beginners and Monster.
Mm. Beautiful. Tristan, how are you this week?
Yeah, I'm good. It's been, it's lovely to be reunited, even though it's only been a week apart, but to have Simon back.
It feels so long for us, Tristan.
It feels so long.
It's definitely like, it feels like we're anticipating the reunion of great duos like Will Smith and Martin Lawrence in the upcoming Bad Boys 4, Ride or Die. So,
does it feel like that?
Well, yeah. It feels like that to me, yeah. Yeah, but it's...
Pam, we've been doing this for 9 years together now.
Wow, right? So, have you been doing it for nine?
Yeah, well, Tristan, together we've been doing it for nine.
Yeah, I know, yes. Tristan's been going longer, but wow, that's a lot of time.
How many years were there between Bad Boys 2 and Bad Boys for Life?
I don't know the exact
it was
number.
16, actually. Yeah.
There you go. But I'm looking forward to that because it feels like when Bad Boys 3 came out, it was like, well, Martin Lawrence needs help with his career. It's good that Will Smith is kind of coming down to do a Bad Boys 3 sequel. And now it feels like Martin Lawrence is helping Will Smith out this time around.
So the bind, yeah.
I feel like every time we reunite, I want to do that parent trap handshake. You know what I'm talking about?
I genuinely don't.
Sometimes my references so don't land. And I
No, no, this is what we need because, I've neglected the cinematic arts, and including The Parent Trap.
Yeah. Iconic movie. Lindsay Lohan plays both twins.
Yes.
And, they're split at birth and it's all very... But anyway, when they reunite at camp, they do this incredible handshake. And me and my sister spent our entire childhoods trying to learn this handshake. We got about halfway through it before we aged out of the movie. But I still return to it and still really love it. And I do imagine in my head sometimes that when you're coming in, we're doing the Parent Trap handshake.
All right, well, maybe we'll... maybe learn what it is and then try and learn it. Maybe in time for when Radiothon has its early birds and we do live movie squad.
I would love that. If you two came in and started doing that handshake, I'd lose my marbles. All right. Well, some other things that are losing their marbles. Maybe the title of this film, Too Many Marbles in the Jar. Tristan, talk to us about Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is the new entry in the long-running franchise, the decade-spanning franchise of the Planet of the Apes movies, which began 1968 with the original film, which was based on the novel by Pierre Boulle, and co-scripted by The Twilight Zone's Rod Serling, and had Charlton Heston and Roddy McDowall, and has, you know, one of the classic twist endings, so much so that it's like was spoiled for everyone. Like growing up, you know, you would just know about the Planet of the Apes ending because of how ubiquitous it is in culture.
Do you know it, Pam?
Nope.
I saw your expression.
Well, maybe that's perfect. You'll be able to watch it and be fully surprised. Like,
it's
the
Earth.
Audience is.
What?
It's Earth.
It's Earth?
Planet of the Apes is Earth.
Oh. Is that
I just wanted to spoil it.
All I know about Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is like. I actually don't know if this is actually to do with it. I think this is King Kong. You know where they hold the tiny woman?
And that's, King Kong.
That's King Kong,
Okay, so I know nothing about Kingdom of the Planet of the
that's
Apes.
Fine.
Well, if you want to know some people who do, check out, I think it was Claude Monet for Golden Apples of the Sun earlier in the year. They did a whole Planet of the Apes special where they went into the music and the soundtrack of all the movies, because there was about 6 or 7 sequels to the original movie. And then we had the Tim Burton remake in 2001 that no one liked, I think. And then the new trilogy, the prequel trilogy that's all about the character of Caesar, who becomes the kind of revolutionary ape leader and shows us how, you know, the Earth developed to get to the point of the Planet of the Apes, with Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, War of the Planet of the Apes. And we're at the point now where those films, I think, are much loved and people are kind of like, you know, talk about the characters in those films to a certain degree. But, you know, there are a lot of ape movies here. Simon, where are you in your standing with the Planet of the Apes franchise?
I've never seen any of the original Planet of the Apes films. Saw the Tim Burton one, hated it. Pam, for your reference, ends with Mark Wahlberg returning, quote-unquote, to Earth, only to find out that the statue of Abe Lincoln is now a monkey dressed as Abe Lincoln.
What?
Ape Lincoln.
Ape Lincoln.
No!
So that's a very bad one. And then I really loved Rise of the Planet of the Apes with Andy Serkis as Caesar, the sort of chief ape, and enjoyed Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and was a bit cool on War of the Planet of the Apes. And maybe we should, for the ease of a conversation, refer to them by their acronyms. Rotpoda, Dotpoda, Wotpoda, and now Cotpoda.
Ah, well done. That's it just rolls off the tongue. Much like Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. But so this new movie is set 300 years after the last one. So it's going to focus on a whole new collection of characters and to possibly, you know, restart the franchise. So I was kind of curious about this one. You know, I like the prequel trilogy, the ones about Caesar that Simon mentioned. But I was like, okay, another Planet of the Apes movie. I'll check it out. And I saw this for a Mother's Day special.
Oh,
so shout out to my mother Liz and my brother Glenn for organizing. But it's set 300 years after the last one. We see that the character of Caesar has died peacefully of old age, and we are introduced to new characters, including Noah, who's played by Owen Teague, who was a child actor in the It movies. He lives in the woods with his clan. They raise eagles, and there's a rite of passage thing about like bonding with your eagle. So while he's hunting for eggs to be part of this ritual, he spots a human. And humans at this stage of the Planet of the Apes movies, they're kind of they're hiding. They're sort of primitives. They are called echoes, and they're basically echoes of a previous world. So the apes rule. Humans are kind of just like scarce. In this kind of situation, the main character, Noah, his clan is invaded by another clan of gorillas. They are kidnapped and enslaved and taken away by the power-hungry ape king Proximus, who's played by Canadian actor Kevin Durand. And there's also another human in the mix, an intelligent human who can talk and think, but is kind of collaborating with the apes and kind of reading history lessons to the main King Ape Proximus. And that's a human played by William H. Macy, who gets to kind of do a William H. Macy character in the world of the Planet of the Apes movies.
Now, that's interesting.
Yes.
Because William H. Macy played one of the apes in the Tim Burton film.
Ooh.
Am I incorrect?
I think you might get him confused with Paul Giamatti, another classic bad guy.
Oh, I did get it. Yeah.
But, no, so basically we watch this this young ape kind of work with the human that he's discovered, Nova, played by Freya Allen from The Witcher, to work together to kind of stop Proximus and free his people. So it's a kind of classic setup for a sort of like fantasy kind of like war kind of type of movie. And it feels like a film in the post-Avatar, you know, sense of the blockbuster, because the human characters are kind of minor. It's really about the apes, these kind of like characters who were created through the actors being in mocap suits and digitally rendered. But the expressions on the apes and the CGI close-ups are fantastic. The performances are all good, particularly Kevin Durand as the villain. And there's another character as well, a wise orangutan called Raka, played by Peter Macon. So this film, King of the Planet of the Apes, I did like. I enjoyed it. It took a while to kind of... It is long, 2 hours and 20 minutes. It took a while for me to kind of get really invested, but I thought there's some really great sequences in here. It's directed by Wes Ball, who was responsible for the Maze Runner trilogy.
Okay,
and there are some action sequences that, you know, bring to mind the Maze Runner, of the kind of obstacle course, like people just like running through kind of like these sort of like jungle gym style amusements. But I thought there were some strong sequences. It set things up for more movies, but I liked The Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. It's not like must-see entertainment, but I liked it. Now, I know, Simon, you haven't seen this, but you were talking before. You weren't, I don't know, does like anything about this kind of like invite you to see it? Are you sort of a bit over the apes?
I'll never be over the apes, but but there's I haven't really been drawn in by this particular film. It's funny because I think the appeal of those, or the prior trilogy, the prequel trilogy, was in laying out the groundwork that wasn't covered by all those predecessors and sequels. And so it kind of feels like these feel more like remakes. And sure. I know they're not. But I just haven't been drawn in by it. What I will say is I'm compelled by two things. One is Wes Ball. I actually think the Maze Runner franchise is really good.
Yeah.
It was sort of like the underrated hero of that whole YA trend. Pam, did you see the Maze Runner films?
I did, and I loved them. Yeah. I thought they were great. I love Kaia Scodelario because I was, you know, obsessed with Skins as a young teen, and she sort of appeared in that. And I love Dylan O'Brien. I think he's so charming and delightful and so silly. Makes a great hero because you believe him. Oh, great. It was great. I thought they were great, but the action sequences were really thrilling. I was engaged in those, like, obstacle course, like, running
sequences. And they're brutal, films. Like, they also have the best subtitles of any, like, The Scorch Trials, The Death Cure. Amazing. Anyway, I recommend The Maze Runner. But the other element that is more appealing to me, Tristan, is that Wes Ball has said that for the DVD and Blu-ray release, they're going to put a cut on there as a special feature of the actors in their mocap suits, but not as apes. And I think that would be so interesting to watch after all these years of actors like Andy Serkis doing this work and that get transformed into spectacular CGI. I kind of would like to see a version where the actors are just sort of doing it, removing that artifice, a bit Dogma 95 style. So that is appealing to me, but I don't feel compelled to see this in cinemas.
Mm. And there's a lot of, like, this was shot in Sydney, there's a lot of location shooting, so there's a kind of physicality to it, even though a lot of it is kind of, like, digitally rendered or added to. So it doesn't feel like you're completely watching an animated movie. But that is an interesting idea to see, the kind of the work that goes into the performances and the animation as well. Now, you know, being Pam, that you're a fan of the Maze Runner movies and not having a lot of history with the Planet of the Apes movies, would you like? Because it feels like you can. This is an entry point in that there's not. There are references to the other movies, but they're all kind of. It's not like you have to do the homework before you can enjoy this one.
Yeah, I like that. I appreciate the idea that you wouldn't have to necessarily do your homework before getting to this movie, but I don't think I want to see it.
Well,
what is the impediment to the whole apes concept?
I don't know if I can put a finger on it, to be honest. I think there's something bizarre. I find things, you know, I find dystopian things. I need a buy-in. So I need an internet boyfriend, or I need, you know, yes. Caius Godelario, or I need a sort of a YA sort of energy about it that makes it feel kind of approachable. And I think that Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes has that dystopian situation going on. And I don't really invite trying to feel weird about my planet. It's weird enough here. Yeah. So it's not something that I seek out in cinema, similar to the way I don't seek out horror movies and being scared in real life, because I am scared all the time anyway. So I don't know. I appreciate it, and I can appreciate advanced CGI, but quite often I find CGI frustrating, and I'm like, that's not real. Why would that be happening? And it's like a very realistic face, but I appreciate the work of it. I don't know if this is a movie for me, but I like the idea that it might be a movie I could watch with other people that love this genre or love this space, and I wouldn't need a buy-in. I wouldn't need to know the plot beforehand. So maybe not for me in cinemas is the answer there.
I'm sure for Planet of the Apes fans, whether because of the original movies or the recent movies, I think they would enjoy Kingdom and to see. I think it's done okay at the box office, but you know, hopefully there's a future. Because watching it, there was a feeling where I was like, well, this could go anywhere. That's not really tethered so much to the previous movies. And so there was a nice kind of feeling at a certain point of like a bit of freedom. But then it definitely does kind of like lean on some like classic tropes of like the objective of the villain and then setting things up for more movies. So that was a bit of the kind of familiar feeling of the contemporary blockbuster. But Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes out in cinemas now.
All right, we're going to get into more movies and all sorts up next.
Baz, excuse me!
Oh my God. We're not a threat. Don't look at us like that. Sorry, I'm...
Yeah, no.
Excuse me? You sure you're in the right place? Feel certain I've never seen you at one of these affairs before.
Little Bo Peep has lost her way.
I don't think she'd be scared. I think she's really braver than you think.
The election was a pre-scripted puppet show, just like every year.
No, you two are a complete pair of cosmopolitan snobs, you know that, yeah?
I need to know what's going on down in that basement now.
What in your young life could you have encountered to inspire you?
I don't know. I never really cared about that stuff. Glad they figured out how to make movies like less boring than this.
Did they?
Track from the next movie's soundtrack. We're going to be talking about The Sweet East, and this is from Talia Ryder, a track from the movie, played this morning at the suggestion of our lovely blockbuster babes, and a really gorgeous one from the movie. I'm sure it'll be contextualised for us, but Simon's going to talk to us about The Sweet East. What can you tell us about this movie, Simon?
The Sweet East is from director... Thank you. My plosives, I've been working on them. It's from director Sean Price-Williams, who is... this is feature directorial debut, but has been working in film for a couple of decades, primarily as a cinematographer, and has been a sort of formative visual voice, if that's an appropriate phrase, by photographing films in the sort of mumblecore era, two decades ago, and then evolving with Alex Ross Perry, a notable director in that genre, who then went on to make films with Jason Schwartzman and Juno Temple and other sort of notable faces, Elizabeth Moss. Very prickly movies, psychodramas in a way, a bit Cassavetes inspired, and then ultimately working with the Safdie brothers. With their sort of guerrilla warfare in New York City and their movies. So really interesting cinematographer and now director. But The Sweet East is based on a script by Nick Pinkerton, who was a film critic. So some kind of interesting collaborators here on this movie. And the song that you heard just there, sung by Talia Ryder, she's the lead of this film. And in it, she plays a teenager going by the name of Lillian. She's on a class trip to Washington, D.C., And then she kind of narrowly escapes a mass shooting at a pizza parlor in a sort of echo of, like, Pizzagate from a few years ago. And in fleeing that moment, she kind of goes on this picaresque journey around certain American states in the east of America, you know, traveling from D.C. She goes to Vermont, she goes to Delaware, she goes to New York. And over the course of this sort of travelogue, this sort of strange psychedelic journey she goes on, or surreal maybe is the better word for it, she kind of falls in with a bunch of extremist groups. At one point, it's the anti-fascists. At another point, it's white supremacists many others, including, comically, a film production crew that is led by a director, Molly, played by Ayo Edebiri from The Bear, and has a leading man played by the world's tallest man, Pam. Who is that?
Jacob Elordi.
That's right, from Euphoria and Saltburn and Priscilla. So that's kind of the bones of the film, I guess. It is an interestingly visual series of vignettes, ultimately, as Lily and this character kind of goes from town to town. Doesn't have much of a personality, per se, besides what she collects from each group. The problem is that each group is very problematic in its own way. Now, I've got some strong feelings and thoughts about the movie, but I know Tristan does as well. Tristan, no. You've seen The Sweet East. Tell me your thoughts about this.
I love when you've both seen it.
I liked it. I wouldn't... Well,
no, you didn't.
No, I thought it was okay. Like, Talia Ryder is really good in the lead. She's great, and then it's a good cast. Though I think the best performance is given by Simon Rex, who has room to breathe as a character, but he's playing a kind of a white supremacist lecturer. Yay. Yeah, and then everyone else kind of is a bit like a sketch character. So if you're a fan of Jacob Elordi and Ayo Edebiri, they in it, but they, you know, not for a long time, I would say. But there was something, I think by the midway point, it looks great as well, obviously through Sean Price Williams being the cinematographer as well. Mm. And there were some really great moments as well. But I think by the midway point, I started getting kind of annoyed and then tired of the film. I think because it is a collection of people talking at the main character, and the main character is so kind of internalized, is not so much of a kind of dynamic presence. She's just really receiving everything that's around her. So I'm sure that for the filmmakers, that's part of the point, that I was annoyed that, you know, this is America, everyone's just like talking at you. And the film just feels kind of like it's being sort of lightly provocative without, you know, having strong convictions, or it's kind of like dipping its toe. Like, it can put up some Lolita-esque imagery, but it's not going to go too far with anything. It can use some non-PC words, but it's going to be okay because it's kind of, that's how kids talk, I guess. But yeah, I think there was something that I just got a bit tired of by the... And I think the last act, there's something that happens in the middle of the movie that's such a kind of a big moment, and then the rest of the film sort of just like limps to the finish line. Oh. And then it uses a lot of like reversals. Like, you think a character's going to do one thing, but they do another. You think a group is going to be this, but they're not. Anyway, so I had an interesting journey with this, and then reading about it as well. But Simon, you saw this as well. Like, did you have a better time with The Sweet East?
I definitely did. Yeah. I liked it much more than you. And I think, you know, you definitely make a point that it's sort of lightly provocative.
Yeah.
But I do like that it, you know, we talk about this sometimes, it is playing with live ammo.
Yes.
And yeah. And it reminded me a lot of a film from a couple of years ago called The Scary of 61st.
Oh, yes.
Directed by Dasha Nekrasova, which is about a house haunted by Jeffrey Epstein. and there are definitely people in the making of this film and in the cast that are associated with what's called the dirtbag left, which is sort of progressive politics but very politically incorrect. and there are echoes of that through the film. But ultimately, I went in completely, you know, not knowing what the film was about, just knowing the actors in it. And Pam, I'm keen to know what you've gleaned from the trailer and what is maybe compelling you to it. But I was surprised at how nihilistic it was, how horrific a vision it was of America. And what it seems to be suggesting is a thesis that I also subscribe to, which is that America is a failed state. It's a cultural void. And the only thing surprising about mass violence in America is, well, which group is responsible for it this time? Mm. And there's so much darkness in this movie that is sort of, you know, cloaked with indie comedy that I thought that was a... I hadn't seen that kind of formulation before, and I found that quite an interesting entryway into what was quite a dystopic vision. Mm. And absolutely, it echoes Alex Ross Perry's film, Mumblecore movies, Safety Brothers. But you take it back to even like Harmony Korine, Gummo, and I'll throw some real, you know, big guns out there, but like Altman's Nashville and Norman Mailer's Maidstone. You know, I'm not saying it's as good as these films, but it definitely feels like a Vietnam era, the world is ending kind of movie. And Talia Ryder, who is a bit of a, you know, a blank space for much of the film by design towards the end of the movie and occasionally throughout, she quite literally gives a wink to the camera and sort of suggests that, you know, she's in on it and she'll take what she needs from this vacuous landscape. Pam, what do you think about what we've said about The Sweet East thus far?
Well, I'm really excited to see Talia Ryder. I saw her in Never Rarely, yes. Sometimes
yeah,
Always.
Great in that.
And she was great in that. I really loved that movie. I think it was one of my top movies of the year that it came out. And I saw it in the cinema. I watched it at home. It was hard to watch and really brilliant. But she was kind of, not blank-faced, but kind of that similar sort of removed kind of presence in that film too, and I think that movie required that, this sort of strange experience that she was going through that also felt really in like reflective of America's sort of state of the union and it being a bit of a failed state. I definitely, you know, was drawn to this movie because of the hotshot names, you know, because I saw Iowa Debris post about it somewhere or Jacob Elordi appearing in it and then sort of stayed for Talia Ryder and the imagery of it. I like that it looks kind of off colour. I love that it's a road movie. I love that we're getting loads of what feel like road movies that are speaking to young people at the moment, which is quite fun and that's intriguing to me. I think I like the idea of, you know, Jacob Elordi or Iowa Debris offending me, like being offended by whatever they present to me. I'm not sure what characters they play in this because obviously I haven't seen it, but I want to see this movie and I like the criticism of the USA as a failed state, you know, and I think that's kind of what it is. The reality of what we're looking at the moment is like all of these voices being a contribution to the mass failure. And, it, you know, that's something that I subscribe to as well. And I love that it's sort of this road movie that explores all the different, you know, people that are responsible for that failure or this that are mucking up the void and mucking up this you know, this space. I'm really intrigued by this movie because it feels like it could be really busy, that it could be a lot. And I like that you've got differing opinions about it. I think I would go and I think I would watch this movie, partly also because it does feel like maybe, you know, it's speaking a little more to people that are around my age, like around, you know, that sort of removal. Do you think that is the case? Do you
think it's very interesting? Because I'd love to hear what you think about it, because I think some people have reacted to it in that way and that they feel that it is talking to them, whereas I feel like it's a bit like Gen X's kind of trying to talk to the kids. Like, there was an element to me where it felt a bit like, oh, you know, we're down, you know, this is cool. And I was just like, I was not buying it. I thought there was something a little bit phony about everything that it was doing.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. And I don't.
But that's my.
No, reaction. And I don't necessarily agree with that part of it because I think it has this, I'll say millennial feel to it, which is maybe not very Gen Z, which is that it's Gen X, but it's sort of disaffected, right? Like when you talk about who it criticizes, again, it's criticizing people, but not institutions. And I think that's a very, that's a very Gen X way of thinking of things as well. So, or maybe it's the reverse of that. I don't know. What I mean by that though, is that it's definitely not a takedown of larger political entities. It's more just like, hey, we're on the roller coaster to hell, so just take what you can from it.
I don't know. I don't mind that sometimes. Sometimes to lean into the... I'm not a nihilist, but sometimes to lean into it is can be a little relieving, can be, you know, if it's done well or if it's done in a kind of validating way. I reckon I'll go see this. I would go see this in the movies, I think. Is it out now?
It is now, only playing at Luna Palace Leaderville in Perth, and, worth... I'd be very keen for people to tell us what they think about The Sweet East.
Okay, 0405-9191. If you've seen it or if you want to see it and you go see it and you maybe want to tell us about what you think about it, we're keen to hear it always. You can send us an email, studio@rtrfm.com.au. Also the way to go, Simon and Tristan, for another great week of movie chats. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. Yeah, I wish... it's one of those things, maybe... because I knew that you saw the Sweeties kind of a bit cold, Simon. You sort of went in without knowing much of it, whereas I was kind of following the different opinions, and overall it's been, I think, been quite positively received, but there have been some kind of more middling or dissenting voices. And it's definitely, I think that, you know, putting all that aside, I think that's the point of the movie, that it is trying to be a little bit provocative and return to those, you know, those films or filmmakers that you talked about that offer kind of a bit of a maybe a difficult time or a bit of a acid burn to the cinematic experience, which generally is few and far between, particularly, I guess, in American filmmaking, to think of people like Harmony Korine or Todd Solondz,
yes,
at this kind of era of all those kind of voices sort of being, I guess, more... less present, maybe. Well, I think that's where the filmmakers are definitely coming from in terms of wanting to make something like this.
Yeah, and this is less a point about the Sweet East and more just a point in general about the state of American indie cinema.
Yeah.
And I know I'm tarring things with a massive brush, and of course there are plenty of amazing, brilliant, wonderful films being made in America.
Yes, yes.
You know, I'm not trying to be that guy. But what an American indie film meant,
yeah,
is a bit different to what it means today, I think, at least mainstream indie, if we can call it that. And so I appreciated what the Sweet East was doing, which is, you know, had some bold-faced names in it, but it's a very, again, whether it works as a provocation or not is up for debate, but it's definitely a prickly film.
Yes.
It's not a film that's trying to win you over by any stretch of the imagination. And it is making a very dark point.
Yeah.
And that's, so I kind of, on those terms, and I did like The Scary of 61st, which I think comes from the same kind of ethos. These films that are like, things are really bad,
yeah,
but maybe let's not be so earnest about it. And I'm all for earnestness in cinema,
yeah,
but there was a, and you made a good point, and it kind of threw me a little bit because I couldn't articulate my thoughts fast enough in
sure.
the pressures of live radio. But saying, like, it felt like a Gen X's kind of perspective
yeah.
on it. And I thought, well, that's an interesting take, because trying to articulate, you know, what does it mean? Like, this disaffected approach.
Yeah.
Okay, yes, maybe it does feel like a Gen X'er speaking to the kids, but am I enjoying it because it feels like the films made by Gen X's, Harmony Korine and what have you.
Yeah.
And those really disaffected early 90s American indie films. That's what I will need more time to untangle in my yeah. own head, but it's a very astute point.
Yeah, and definitely, like, you know, maybe to go in cold, I wouldn't have had maybe some of those associations. And The Scary of the 61st, I didn't like either. And there's something about... you know, I don't need, like, a film to have likable characters. I don't need for it to be, like, optimistic or earnest. Like, you know, maybe I just need it to be funnier or maybe to have more ideas. I think sometimes these filmmakers or this kind of, like, Red Scare podcast adjacent, you know, a New York circle, they sort of like, you know, throw the dice in a couple of things, but it doesn't feel like... You know, and yeah, maybe it doesn't need to be, but maybe it just, like, for me, it just needed to be a bit more funnier. And then it just seems like with some of these things, there's no kind of position. Like, even if you get annoyed or if you don't like something, then that's intentional or like, you know, that was part of the point. So you feel like you just go, okay, you've won. I submit.
I'm definitely no champion of the dirtbag left. Let me put that out there. What I will say, and I wasn't going to mention this on the live radio, obviously,
yeah.
but a film it did remind me of, and is probably more successful as a provocation, is the movie Assholes, with right. Peter Vack and Betsy Brown, who both sort of have cameos in
yes.
this film as well. Now, they're interesting figures in the films that they make, and I'm not celebrating the other films necessarily
yeah.
they've made, but that movie definitely has that guerrilla Safdie Brothers
yeah.
Style to it, and is a very visceral provocation and a nihilistic look at, you know, New York City and surrounds. So it feels like there's this, you know, now we can look back on certain eras and
yeah.
say, like, these were the films being made in this time, and this is what they were commenting on. Sweet East feels like it's part of a story that's being told
yeah.
about today, and I'll be interested to see, you know, in 10 years' time
yeah.
how we assess this cluster of movies.
That's a very good point. And, yeah, and look, so it's definitely out in cinemas now, and much respect and appreciation to indie distributors like Static Vision, who have helped, you know, get it out into cinemas when it looked like it might not reach Australian cinemas. So, yeah, follow Static Vision for other kind of indie DIY kind of distribution of films like this. But before we wrap up, you mentioned that you caught up with Challengers, and I just wanted to touch base with you, Simon, and see, like, because that is a film where I feel like, you know, when it was kind of announced or when I was seeing kind of press about it, I thought, a tennis film with Zendaya, with Luca Guadagnino, it might be interesting, it might be good, but it feels like, and I don't know if this will last the test of time for 10 years, but it feels like it's definitely captured a zeitgeist in a way that people are kind of like the kids, as they were, maybe it's my wrong perspective, are caught up in, you know, Challenger's fever. I don't know. Like, how do you feel?
These kids, they've got Challenger's fever. No, it does feel like that, but I'm also conscious of, like, the letterboxed Instagram bubble, right? So what I will say is seeing the film absolutely answered the question I put to you two weeks ago, which is, like, does it feel like a Luca Guadagnino film? Does it feel tactile? Are there, you know, is it, this is such a horrible phrase, but I'll return to it because when I think of his films, I think of fluids. Like,
Put that on the poster. Yeah. Put that on his, like, autobiography.
Yeah, I think of fluids. I'm not even going to try and rephrase what I'm thinking, but in general, so yeah, last week I had to be in Melbourne and I visited the Cinema Nova, which is one of my favourite cinemas over there. Mm. I was trying to see a film there when I'm in town and saw Challengers with the crowd, and it was such a tactile, fluid-filled movie. Gosh, I really have to find a better way to articulate what I'm trying to say there. But the audience was sort of oohing and ahhing along with the entire movie, and it kind of, the movie comes to a literal climax, like this orgiastic conclusion, and the audience were like flushed at that point. So I really, really dug it, and it did feel like a Luca Guadagnino movie to that end. It was just such an energetic and ribald soap opera.
Yeah.
And I kind of loved it for that. I wasn't on board from the get-go. Like, I was going like, okay, this is great. But it so won me over.
Yeah, wonderful.
It was a really pleasing cinema experience. And my if you would ask me to, like, write the review or articulate in writing what the film is about, what that ending means, etc., like you and like Pam, I'm sure, they're words we would never utter on the radio for fear of a broadcaster's fine or something like that. But I feel very clearly about what the movie is and about.
Yes.
is that cagey enough way to describe it?
I think
the kids or people who are seeing it and responding to it, I think they get it.
Yeah.
I think they get that this is a movie about sex and I think they're responding to that in a way. You know, there's all this conversation around how sex is missing from the movies these days. Yeah. And there's a puritanism, which again is why I enjoy something like The Sweet East, which is like at least thumbing its nose at puritanism to a degree. It was nice to see a film that was just filthy without being graphic.
Yeah, it's a very interesting, because, you know, there's like lots of different like reviews or articles that have sprung up, and like there's, you know, much like some of the criticisms of Call Me By Your Name, that there's not enough sex or there's not enough kind of a graphic quality, and whether, like, you know, and, you know, when I say the kids, like, I'm old, so I can't say that I know what the you know, the kids, but I'm only basing this on like social media kind of engagement and, you know, everyone's love of Josh O'Connor or, you know, three tickets to Challengers, please, that kind of meme. But it feels like, yeah, it's tapped into something without, you know, repeating the kind of the modes of representing sex that maybe growing up we were used to from the films from the 80s or the 90s. So that even though for some it might be lacking, or it's like, you know,
it is a little chaste. Within reason. But like, and I'm not saying that's a good thing.
No. But it's like, it seems like it's found another way to kind of, to convey that energy or convey that you know, flushness without the you know, the blowing curtains and the you know, the top
cutting
gun
to, cutting to the
like,
train,
you know,
going into the tunnel. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's great. what a note to end on. Thank you so much, Simon. Thank you all for listening to the Movie Squad podcast. We'll be back with another great episode next week.